Hello again, everyone. Your attention, please. We're beginning the program with a sound of applause to let everyone know that we're... Well, that was weak. Yeah, that's a Reagan. That's much more gleam in the eye. All right. For those of you just joining us, the program is still beginning. By the way, I want to welcome all of those, and it could be thousands of people again, watching on yaf.org, yaf.org. Make that, you know, bookmark that. Use that a lot. Let's welcome those who are watching online right now as well. Thank you. We love you. Thank you for tuning in. And for those of you just joining us, or if you weren't paying attention earlier, I'm still Mark Larson, your friendly board member, Reagan Ranch Board of Governors, radio TV host in San Diego. And I just have to say this again. Not that you get strong-armed when you come here to support Young America's Foundation and specifically the Reagan Ranch, but yeah, over the years you say, people say, well, you're involved there. What, you know, that sounds really good. Those campus lectures and so forth. One of these days, I'll really get, you know, when things get really challenging, then maybe I'll do that. It's like if you're looking at the news now, you know, if you're just looking at the opposition now, if you're just looking at what passes now for great statesmanship, in places like Washington, D.C. and Sacramento. Yeah, I don't know what you're waiting for. So this is the time to say, yeah, okay, I'll give a little bit. No, give a lot. I mean, join. Don't just buy the calendar. You get the mailings from Ron every year. You'll get calendars, you know, 50 years after you pass away. God bless you. You'll get those calendars. But that's good. But join the President's Club, Rawhide Circle. Look at the living legacy kind of thing, the Ranch in the Sky. There's so many different options. Because then you're not just a spectator. You're not watching the news going, well, look at that. Or look what happened to that speaker trying to just speak the truth on a campus. You're actually making a difference. And that makes the news a whole lot more interesting when you're working on the answer, doesn't it? Absolutely. So applaud yourself for the donations you'll be making in coming months. Because then you can come to President's Club events. Rawhide, the whole bit. And by the way, we want to thank our catering crew here. They are fantastic. They're kind of within earshot. Make sure they can hear you, all of our servers. Many of them have been with us for many, many years, and we love that. And, you know, when we're controversial members of the media, it's always good to know who's cooking your food, just in case, you know, just to be sure. Now, because of the weather delays and so forth today, just understand that we're not going to cut you off. If you come to other events and you think, well, I'm going to be about 1:30 and we're going to be done. No. We're going to go to about 1:45. We're going to make sure you get the full program. No refunds. You'll have a chance to get the books from David Bossi. The books available afterward. And we're going to have a great time today. What an interesting, timely day to have Dave Bossi here. You think? He and I have known each other about 20 years, and Sarah's going to do the full official introduction here, but I feel really comfortable when there are people I know within the White House or wherever it happens to be, because it you just kind of sit back as the opposition will say, it's chaos, it's hair on fire, and you kind of go, no, there's actually some really good people understanding with positions of influence in and outside of the White House, and we just have to make sure that when our side is there, that we don't take anything for granted, which gets back to being involved and making a difference and you know, be on the field, not just a spectator. So thank you for all you do with that. To introduce officially David Bossi, Sarah Matheson is assistant to the director of the Reagan Ranch. She became involved with the YAF during college and has loved being a part of the YAF team in Santa Barbara. Sarah's commitment to the conservative movement started at a young age when she, because her dad was working for the senator. Senator Mike Lee's first campaign, she started volunteering, which I assume was Boyd saying, you're going to be volunteering now. Yeah. In addition, Sarah worked as communications manager for the Utah-based nonprofit Women Tech Council, researching and promoting the economic impact of women in tech companies. She helped connect thousands of high school and college female students with major STEM industry partners, including Adobe, Qualtrics, eBay, and Netflix, a couple of companies you might have heard of, opening doors to internships and future careers for those students. She has a bachelor's degree in communications with emphasis in public relations from Brigham Young University. Please welcome Sarah Matheson to officially, classily introduce David.
Uh, First off, we'd just like to again welcome all those who are joining us via our virtual pass. For everyone who is on YAF's Facebook page or YouTube channel, just click the link in the description or head over to yaf.org/virtualpass, and you can ask David Bossy your questions today and hear your answers here after he speaks. If you're watching through YAF Virtual Pass, you can submit your questions using the box on the right side of your screen. Don't forget to tweet along, hashtag only at YAF, to share what David has to say today. Now, in introducing Mr. Bossy, I first met Dave Bossy at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio in 2016. And I'm sure that he doesn't quite remember this. He had a few things on his plate during that week. But my dad and I, along with quite a few members of the Utah delegation, ran into him and we talked briefly as he caught up with my dad. He then looked at our group of 20 people and offered us a ride back to our hotel in West Akron, convinced that we could most definitely fit 20 people in the 8-passenger Suburban. Since then, I've watched Mr. Bossy help lead the Trump campaign to victory, head the Trump transition team, and author multiple books. After watching all of that and more, I think it's safe to say that he probably could have fit those 20 people in the 8-passenger Suburban. It's safe to say that David Bossy is an expert at tackling seemingly impossible circumstances and successfully surpassing all expectations. David Bossy has a list of accolades and accomplishments listed in your program that highlight the incredible work he has done as the president of Citizens United. It is important to note that behind his long list of accomplishments is a leader with a drive and passion for protecting and promoting conservative principles. He successfully won a landmark First Amendment decision at the United States Supreme Court in Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission. Under Bossy's leadership, this case struck down two decades of unconstitutional restrictions on free speech put in place by the federal government. Anyone who has worked with or gone up against Mr. Bossy will surely tell you of his dogged determination to protect the freedoms and values of America. He worked as the former chief investigator for the United States House of Representatives Committee on Government Reform and Oversight. During Bill Clinton's two terms as president, he led investigations ranging from the Whitewater land deal to the foreign fundraising in the 1996 Clinton re-election campaign. He has authored four books, including the best-selling book Intelligence Failure: How Clinton's National Security Policy Set the Stage for 9/11. His most recent book, Trump's Enemies, will be available for purchase and signing in the Welcome Center after his speech today. As you can see, Mr. Bossy has figuratively put 20 people in 8-passenger Suburbans consistently throughout his career. Along with all of these accomplishments, Mr. Bossy has been a great advocate for Young America's Foundation and our student programs. His commitment and investment in the rising generation has helped inspire thousands to continue on the Reagan-like traditions of unflinching commitment to hard work, freedom, and opportunity for all. Please join me in welcoming David Bossy.
Wow, that was a fabulous introduction. I'm actually going to fly you around the country with me because that was awesome. So thank you very much. It's so good to be here back at with Young America's Foundation, back at the Reagan Ranch Center. I've had the honor and pleasure of knowing Ron Robinson for a very, very long time. Ron gets older. I don't. And so that's a, I hope he's listening. It is such a pleasure because I got a chance to visit with Ron before he and I talked about the purchase of the Reagan Ranch property. That's how, and he has done such an amazing job, and Young America's Foundation has done such an amazing job preserving the history of Ronald Reagan, right? The ideals, the culture, the conservative beliefs, that hope, growth, and opportunity that Ronald Reagan stood for with Young America's Foundation and with the Reagan Ranch Center. So I just want to thank Ron Robinson for having me. I want to thank Wendy McCaw for having the foresight for sponsoring this series of speeches. It's truly a pleasure. I want to thank Mark Larson for being here. He's a long, long time friend. Please stop flying planes. I'm with your wife. I've seen you drive. It's just not good. Just saying. Okay. I know you got a real pilot with you. You know, but. And then Andrew Coffin and the staff, they're just so amazing. Every time I come, I just am blown away by it. John and Judy, thank you guys for coming. And I want to thank my son for doing the pledge. But, you know, he traveled out here with me, and we got here at 1:30 this morning after the little story. But these guys came down to L.A. and picked us up, and I felt bad for them. But we had to get here, and I appreciate it. Look, I've turned 18 years old when Ronald Reagan was being reelected in November of 1984. My birthday is November 1st, so I literally got to vote for Ronald Reagan by 3 days. And it was truly the bedrock of who I ended up being, and from a standpoint of watching as a young person the 4 years of Jimmy Carter, and then the 4 years of Ronald Reagan. It wasn't difficult. I really wish that we could have more people understand the differences, right? Of weaknesses, of malaise, of an economy that was just being destroyed by Jimmy Carter's policies, and then the 4 years of Ronald Reagan. And, oh, wait a minute, we are actually about to see that because Donald Trump has taken a broken economy and a weak foreign policy and really in 2 years has turned it into a juggernaut, right? After 8 years of Obama's destruction. So it's a lot of fun for me having I've known the president for a long time. Actually, met him in 2010. And so I've gotten a chance to know the president for a very long time. And I actually met the president because of my son. And so it was a unique opportunity. My family has been trying to help Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C., and we were hosting a fundraiser. And I reached out to somebody to help us. And he said, yeah, I'm going to help you, but my friend Donald Trump, he might help you. And he introduced me to him, and it was a long friendship I've just really been blessed by. And so when the president was then the candidate, or actually before he was a candidate, he and I would talk about these, about him potentially running. And so I introduced him to Corey Lewandowski, who became the first campaign manager, and I recommended Corey for that job, and I helped put together the original team. And then when the president called me, then the candidate called me in August when the day he fired Paul Manafort. And he said, would you please come to New York and help manage the campaign with Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway? And, you know, when you're a friend of somebody's, becoming their employee changes things. But when the nominee calls and I'm a duty guy, I felt that it was my duty to do it. And I did, and I dropped everything. I took a leave of absence from Citizens United, the organization I've been running since 2000. And by the way, Ron Robinson's on my board of directors and has been since 1988, when Citizens United was first founded. It's just been an unbelievable experience to go to New York and manage that campaign, try to right that ship. Everybody wrote us off, right? Literally on election day, we wake up, and you know the little barometers that these brilliant people at the newspapers and and the networks have? They literally, the New York Times, the Washington Post, gave us less than 1% chance of victory. Less than 1%. There's only two people in the race. We're like, what are you doing? You can't even give us a 5% shot. You can't give us a 2% shot. 1%. 1%. We were like, come on, this is crazy, right? So as the day progressed, those numbers changed a little bit. And it was funny because they were doing it real time as the results were coming in. And I had the pleasure of standing next to then candidate Trump on election night, and I was the real-time data guy, so I was passing him the information in these states. And my son Griffin was with me, and it was an unbelievably magical night because, you know, as these things come in, and you know they said we're not going to be able to win Florida, we're not going to be able to win North Carolina, we're not going to win Ohio and Iowa, and I knew we were going to win them all. I was only one of three people who thought that, but I did know that. That was my job, so I did know that. As the deputy campaign manager, the one thing I was trying to do was focus on our path to victory. And it was a wild ride. But on election night, as Florida came in and North Carolina came in and Ohio came in and Iowa came in, and the earth started to shake in Manhattan, right? Because if you remember, Crooked H, what I still call Hillary Clinton, Crooked H was across the street from us. It was the first time in American history where not only were the two nominees for president in the same state, in the same city, we were literally a golf ball hit away from Hillary Clinton. And if Donald Trump knew where she was, he probably would have hit the golf ball, it was my guess. But it's funny. Remember they canceled their fireworks display? You remember that? And Mr. Trump came to me and said, hey, let's see if we can buy them. He says, offer them 10 cents on the dollar. That's the guy he is, right? It was funny, but you know, we end up winning. It was a long night. Everybody remembers that. But it's literally been every minute of every day since then, not 1 minute of a break, no honeymoon. We were told the next day I got named the deputy for the transition team. So I was the number two for the presidential transition team. And I got, I was the guy who interacted with the Secret Service. And they came in and said, hey guys, we got some people coming to the building. So everybody needs to stay on this floor. And the next day, and you remember the people marching down Fifth Avenue to Trump Tower? Literally the first day. And it's been going on ever since. The Clinton campaign, which of course criticized then candidate Trump for not admitting that he would accept the results of the election, right? Okay, remember all of that? Well, 2.5 years later, Hillary Clinton still has not accepted the results of the election. And she was obviously heavily medicated that night, we all know, because she couldn't come out and give her speech because she was inconsolable, because they thought they had it in the bag. And they had to have an excuse as to why they did not win. And what's that excuse now, 2.5 years later? The Russian hoax. It is the biggest load of malarkey, and I'm so offended by it, okay? A lot of my colleagues, and I've been very lucky, and I'll knock on wood here, but I've been very lucky because the guy we call Uncle Bob, you don't want to buy a ticket to Uncle Bob's, and that's Bob Mueller. You don't want to buy a ticket to the show, in essence, right? Which is this junk of an investigation. It's offensive to me, but what they've put my friends and colleagues through, the hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees that people have to pay out of their own pockets to defend themselves from nothing, from literally garbage. It is something that's never been seen before in America, and it's dangerous. And so we have the mainstream media that's against this president, right? The fake news, which is what the president calls it. And by the way, you know, he's incredibly proud of the fact that he, in the last 2 years, has educated the American people to the existence and to the depth of the fake news. What Jim Acosta, that's right, what the men and women of the so-called media do, right? They're advocates for the left, right? The New York Times is a super PAC for the Democrat Party, okay? That's what they are, and it's really pretty remarkable. So in our book, Trump's Enemies, it's the first time the president sat for an interview for a book in the first 2 years. And Corey Lewandowski and I sat down in the Oval Office with the President of the United States for an interview. Now, we've spent thousands and thousands of hours with the man and know him incredibly well, but we had never interviewed a president before. Hell, I had never interviewed anyone before, and neither had Corey. So the first interview we ever do is with the president. We were a little bit, we were a little nervous, and it was fairly entertaining. But we put that full interview in the book, and because we wanted people to understand directly from him, which is the power of Donald Trump, right? He speaks directly to people, whether it's through Twitter, and people can agree or disagree on his use of Twitter, but he speaks directly to them. That's why the rallies, right? That's why the rally in Texas on Monday, right? He spoke directly to the American people. How about that State of the Union address last week? Quite honestly, you know, I told the president, I was with the president on Wednesday for a long time, and and we talked about the speech, and I said, sir, I think this goes down. I think this was the greatest speech I've seen him give literally thousands of speeches. I said, I think this is the greatest speech you've ever given. And and Corey agreed with me, and I said, every president has major speeches that they're remembered for, right? Ronald Reagan, right? The Berlin Wall speech, right? Tear down this wall. The Point to Hawk speech, the boys of Point to Hawk, right? I mean, President Reagan is known for a lot of great speeches, let's be honest. But most presidents, you can remember one or two. I think that speech last Tuesday is one of the greatest speeches that he will have ever given after his second term is done, because he is going to get reelected, and I'm looking forward to helping him do that. But so look, we have a lot of, I get asked a lot of questions, and I hope people are thinking of questions that I can take when we're done here. But I get a lot of questions about the White House staff, right? Like who are the good guys and who are not the good guys? And the president's always been deeply concerned because, you know, you look at this fight we're in today, right? The president did the executive order, declares a national emergency, gets $1.37 billion to help build the wall. I blame one person for that, and I don't know what y'all are going to think of this, but there's really one person to blame for the president's having to do this today, and that's Paul Ryan. Okay, Paul Ryan is one of the reasons that we have people who are not supporters of this president that work in the White House. Paul Ryan's one of the reasons that we didn't get a legislative accomplishments list that was incredible in the first 2 years when he had the power to do so. Paul Ryan's the reason that we didn't get the wall funded, that the president has to go and do this today. These are not things that happen just in a vacuum. And so people have to remember the big picture. And we had the House and the Senate for 2 years. What did we do? Okay, that's the level of disappointment that the president has in these people. He understands what's going on. But if you look last week as an example, somebody leaked the president's 3 or 4 months of his schedule. Who does that? It's so dishonest to work there in the White House complex for the president of the United States. There's not a lot of people that work inside the fence of the White House, right? It's the West Wing and it's the OEOB. That's the complex. And there's a few thousand people that work there. But not everybody had access to the schedule. A couple hundred did, a few hundred. But the point is they made it into his use of what's called executive time. That it was ridiculous. Look, I'm on a schedule a lot, whether it's phone calls or meetings. I've never been on a schedule that I've seen, because it's in the executive time. He's meeting with people all the time. He's meeting with friends, advisors, business leaders, community leaders all the time. This guy is the world. Who thinks the president doesn't work hard? He is the hardest working man I've ever been around in my life. And so, you know, just to put a fine point on that, Donald Trump, during the campaign, we were doing 6 events a day, 6 speeches where he would speak for 1 hour at a time. 6 of those a day in 2 or 3 time zones every day. And then we would leave the last place and go to where we're starting the next day. The guy would get 4 or 5 hours of sleep max, and he would do 6 events a day. I couldn't hardly keep up with him. Our younger staff, they were dragging. But this guy is a machine. And we did it on 3 food groups, which the president still yells at us about, telling everybody, because the 3 food groups are McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and pizza. And so, you know, in our first book, which was about the 2016 campaign called Let Trump Be Trump, we wrote about the 3 food groups and the what we had to do as a staff to try to live through that, and the vanilla fingers, that was the 4th food group, if there was one. And and the president was like, how come you guys had to say that in the book? And we were like, sir, well, it wasn't exactly a secret. You used to tweet pictures of yourself eating McDonald's. So we didn't know that was like a secret, and he just busted our chops on it. But he's the hardest working guy. And what I said earlier today to somebody was, you know, we were doing 6 events a day, and there were 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 people at an event in an arena with more outside, whether it was 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 additional. 6 times a day. Hillary Clinton could hardly fill a high school cafeteria once a day. And by the way, that's an intensity thing that guys like me pay attention to. That's not a small thing. So we look at the person who did this leak of the schedules. And I'm so disappointed that that person works there. They should resign, and they should say who they are, and they should be gone. I talked to Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House Chief of Staff, the other day, and he thinks that they're going to figure out who did it. And I can't wait to see that, because I would love to see the perp walk on that, right, on television. That would be nice. But it reminds me, that event reminded me that the author of the anonymous letter that was posted in the New York Times a few months ago has still not been found and still works there. And by the way, it's not the same person. If it was the same person, the media would have made us know it's the same person, but it's not the same person. So that's the problem with dealing with when you have a candidate who's the ultimate political outsider, right? Somebody who's not an establishment figure. Donald Trump came to Washington, he kicked in the door and he flipped over a couple of desks and he said, okay, I'm here, let's get started, right? The establishment on both sides don't like that. And you look, what a great job the establishment's done, right? $22 trillion in debt. The debt's gone. Barack Obama doubled our debt from 10 to 20 in 8 years. Now, part of that is a Republican Congress. I'll say, you know, we can't just say it's all their fault, our own people. And so we have a president who's working hard, who deserves people around him who are dedicated to his America First agenda. And there are plenty of people who are not. And then you look at his administration and you see guys inside the Justice Department who are bad guys, right? It's astonishing to me that the president has to put up with, first, his biggest mistake, and I personally am very good friends with Jeff Sessions, but that was a major error by Jeff to recuse himself when he did not need to. And that one decision in and of itself cascaded, waterfalled into what we have today, which is this 2 years later, 2.5 years later. The Mueller investigation, Bob Mueller's been on the job like 22 months, 22 months at about $40 million. Think about that for a second. And when that report comes out, I want to see it. And I want every American to see it. You know, Sarah was saying that I served as the chief investigator in Congress. And so I helped lead the Whitewater Committee in the Senate and then the House committees up through impeachment in the House when Newt Gingrich was Speaker. And it is it's an amazing thing to watch this two sets of rules. It's two sets of rules. One set of rules for the Trump people and one set of rules for the Clinton and everyone else, right? I'm astonished by it. And I want to see the defenders of Bob Mueller answer these questions if this report is made public, and it needs to be made public. We, the American people, must demand that it is made public. Because once transparency hits that report, we're going to see exactly how Bob Mueller treats James Comey. How does he treat Andy McCabe? How does he treat Peter Strzok and Lisa Page? How does he treat James Baker, who was the chief counsel for the FBI? How does he, and all of these people have been fired. All of these people have been fired from the FBI for a reason. And so we need to see, Mueller's defenders for the last 2 years have been saying, Mueller is dispassionate and just following the facts and evidence. It's just facts and evidence. He's only doing the right thing. Well, we're going to see if what he says about Peter Strzok, the FBI agent who led the investigation into Hillary's emails. We saw what happened with that, right? Nothing, right? How many of you would like to see the end of that investigation, right? We'd all like to see what could happen if there was an actual investigation. Peter Strzok led that investigation inside the FBI. Peter Strzok gave Cheryl Mills and Heather Samuelson immunity and let Huma Abedin off, right? And part of those deals was to destroy their emails and to destroy their phones and laptops. Literally, part of the deal was, in return for immunity and their testimony, there would be a destruction of that evidence so nobody could go back and figure out what they did or didn't do. It's outrageous. So this same FBI agent who allows the Clinton people to get off scot-free, gives them immunity, and nobody gets prosecuted for anything. Same guy, Peter Strzok, interviews Michael Flynn, a 3-star American hero who, now, when you're an FBI agent, you have requirements under the code of conduct for the FBI that is, when you conduct an interview, you have to write an investigative report of the interview. It's not tape recorded, so it's not verbatim. It's to the best of your recollection, okay? And the report is called a 302. That's what the name of the report is for an FBI agent that completes after an investigation, after an interview with somebody. And you're supposed to do it within a matter of days because you're only human and you're working on cases. You have to disgorge it onto a piece of paper so that you have it as part of your fact-based FBI investigation, your report, your ongoing investigation, so that others on the team can read your interview results. So you're supposed to do that within days, maybe a week. You could even linger a little bit if you're really busy. Peter Strzok interviewed Mike Flynn, and he wrote a 302 10 months later. 10 months. And it was that 302 report that they matched up against an earlier interview, which James Comey, the fraud of an FBI director, said that first interview should never have happened because they didn't do it the right way. Okay, they went into the White House as soon as Mike Flynn was named, right after the inaugural, before the White House counsel's office was set up. They circumvented the White House counsel and they sat down with Mike Flynn and they did this interview. Same guy, Peter Strzok, who had the insurance policy, right? Who said, we are never going to allow Donald Trump to be elected to begin with. This is what is happening. The same FBI agent lets off the Clinton people and is trying to railroad trying to stop President Trump from becoming president. And then once they're made, once he is elected, they try to, I call it a coup, right? This is what bad guys are trying to do to a duly elected president. These are not small things. And that is why the Mueller report must be made public. We have to see, did Bob Mueller follow the facts and evidence as it relates to Peter Strzok's activities, to Lion Andy McCabe's activities, right? Andy McCabe's a bad guy. He was fired by the FBI with cause. His wife ran as a Democrat for office in Virginia. Terry McAuliffe, the Clintons' original bag man, gave Andy McCabe's wife $750,000 to run for the state Senate in Virginia. Think about that for a second. That's not a conflict of interest if you're Andy McCabe. Of course it is. If you think Jeff Sessions needs to recuse himself because he runs into the Russian ambassador at a public event in a receiving line, that's the level of what got Jeff Sessions to recuse himself. And Jeff, to his defense, said, you know what? I'm going to do it. It will look like I'm doing the right thing. It'll be better for the president. It was a moment of weakness, in my opinion. He made a bad decision because now we've seen what James Comey has done. James Comey needs to be held to account. He leaked information, right? We know that. He lied maybe on three occasions to the Senate committee. Where is the same SWAT team that kicked in Roger Stone's door? How come they're not surrounding any of these people's homes and hauling them away in handcuffs? It's the two sets of rules. One set of rules for anybody associated with the president, one set of rules for the Clinton side. And so I've been, you know, I defended James Comey for a long time. In the first year of the administration, first 6 months, I said James Comey is the last Boy Scout. James Comey is somebody who really is in his very being, the fiber of his being, is about the Constitution and the rule of law. And the reason I know that is I worked with James Comey. I know Jim from the 1990s. We worked on the Whitewater Committee together. People don't know that James Comey worked on that committee. So I know him. And I saw him during the transition and spoke to him. And I always thought highly of James Comey. But having seen the carnage that he has brought onto our country, and he and a few others, Rod Rosenstein, okay? I hope he's packing his stuff now that Bill Barr is our new attorney general as of yesterday. I don't know. Did he get sworn in yet? I didn't see. He was sworn in. So I'm hoping that the new attorney general is going to replace Rod Rosenstein any minute. It's important. When you are talking to people about wearing a wire in the White House, when you are talking about invoking the 25th Amendment, you got to go. You got to go. Okay? So if you think about this, James Comey, Andy McCabe, Rod Rosenstein, James Baker, who was the chief counsel at the FBI, the top five guys have been fired. Not fired by the president because the president doesn't like them, but for cause, for leaking information, for not following FBI protocol. They have been fired and they are looked at by the agency now. I talked to a lot of FBI agents. The FBI has been a pillar of America. I grew up loving the FBI. And we all should. The problem is they needed new leadership. They need to clean house and you need the transparency of the Mueller report to help close this loop so that we can build the reputation of the FBI back to what it was. because it's important for the American people to have confidence in the FBI. I want to have confidence in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So look, I have, I get to travel the country. I get the benefit of traveling with the president a lot, and I get to talk to him a lot and see him and understand what he's going through. And I get the privilege of coming out across the country as often as I can to tell people what's going on, the real story of what he's going through, of what his family has to go through every single day. By the way, in this book, Trump's enemies, in our interview with the president, the first question I asked him was, because I thought I was really a genius, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna ask him something he's not gonna expect, you know. And I said, Mr. President, after everything you've gone through for the last 2 years, after everything that Don Jr. and Eric and Melania and Barron, right, and the rest of the kids have had to go through, after knowing today what they've had to do for the last 2 years, what you've been through for the last 2 years, do you regret running for president? And he looked at me and he was like, are you kidding me? He's like, this is the greatest job in the world. I am able to make a difference for the American people every single minute of every single day. I wake up every day asking, who am I fighting for today? That is who we have as a president. He is somebody who is not bowed by what's gone on over the last 2 years. He says, this is so important. Everything I've ever done in the past, right? Real estate, the biggest real estate guy in the country, number one TV shows, number one books, 20 books. He's like, that's baby talk. He's like, that literally does not even matter. It doesn't even register with me anymore. This job, what I'm doing today, making and having completed the promises that I made to the American people, fighting for our economy. You look at this, Barack Obama drove our economy in after 8 years literally to a grinding halt. Okay, we were at 1.6, 1.8, 2.2% GDP, right? This president has had a resurgence of our economy, not because of what, look, I love that Barack Obama loves to run around the country and say it's all him now, right? Right? Everybody's like, oh, this is the Obama era administration's policies coming through today. That's not true at all. Okay, what's true is business understood they have a businessman at the helm now. Somebody who's business friendly. You look at the deregulation in the first year. You look at the tax cut. You look at the regulatory reform packages. You look at what this president has done as far as a business friendly environment. Barack Obama said, "What are you going to do? Have a magic wand to bring back, manufacturing jobs?" We lost an entire generation of jobs in this country, manufacturing jobs. We've had almost 600,000 new manufacturing jobs in this country over the last 2 years. We have a 4% unemployment rate. 4%. That's my time's up. No, just kidding. So it is 4% unemployment. The lowest African American unemployment rate in recorded history. The lowest Hispanic unemployment rate in American history. The lowest female unemployment rate. Wages have gone up 3%, the most in a decade. That is not a president who's only president for a small group of people. He wakes up every day and he believes that he is president of all Americans and doing the job for all Americans, and that by doing these things, it raises all boats. And if you look at the results, not rhetoric, results, you look at the tangible numbers of our economy, you look at what's going on across this country, a resurgence in our economy, consumer confidence, every economic matrix you have is going in the right direction. You look at the Dow, which I, you know, some days I like to look at, some days I don't. I'm like everybody else, but it is remarkable, right? It is remarkable what he has done for the wealth of this country over the last 2 years. And he's only just begun. That's the thing. If we and so I am going to be doing everything I can over the next 18 months to make sure that he gets another 4 years to do that, because it is vital that we don't let the left take over this country. Because if you see, you guys look around, you look at these literally insane left-wing politicians who are coming up talking about, quite frankly, scary socialist platforms. Scary. Look, in 2015 and 16, when it was Bernie Sanders, we all could laugh at a little old crazy Bernie, because he was just the outsider. Hillary Clinton was going to win the nomination. He, you know, Bernie Sanders never really had a chance, right? We know, but that's different today. He was the outsider. Now that's the mainstream of the Democrat Party, right? It is the mainstream of the left that this Cortez or whatever her name is, the young woman, and I don't want to be disrespectful that I don't know her name, but AOC, whatever it is a the Green New Deal. Give me a break. Look, she couldn't even launch the thing competently, right? She's so incompetent, she couldn't even launch it, right? And then they lied about the launch. Look, these people, you could laugh at them if they weren't so scary and we weren't in such scary times. It is very dangerous if we have a leftist resurgence in this country like we've never seen before, really. Not a resurgence, but an effort that in 2020 we have a House, potentially a Senate, and a White House that is controlled by not just what we used to call liberals, but radical socialists who want to change this country. Look, you know, I love my friend Larry Kudlow. I don't know if you guys do as well, but my friend Larry Kudlow, who is such a great man, doing a great job as the president's economic advisor. You know, he said he was yelling at me the other day because I did something on Lou Dobbs, and he was like, well, you got to talk about these numbers more. And I said, well, you know, not everybody's Larry Kudlow. I'll do the best I can. But here, you know, he wanted me to focus on this, and that is the top 1% of earners pay 37% of the taxes. Top 1% pay 37% of all taxes in America. The top 5% of earners pay 58% of all taxes in America. The top 5% pay 58%. The top 10% pay almost 70%. Okay, so the top 10% pay the top 70% pay 70% of all taxes. The top 25%, 86%. I mean, we don't have a problem with people who are earning more, paying more, right? I mean, that's just, it's already the way it is. But you want to destroy this country. Let's go back to the economy of 1.5 to 2% GDP, stagnation, right? We're going to have inflation and unemployment ballooning. We cannot go back, folks. These people that have taken over the Congress, there's a big group. It is scary. And we have to be cognizant. We have to fight it at every turn. And that's one of the reasons that I love Young America's Foundation, is that they're out there trying to change the next generation. Because that's how we're going to have to win this battle. Okay? Talking to the next generation. And, you know, my wife, actually, when she was in college, went to a Young America's Foundation seminar, and so did I. Now, not at the same one, But Ron loves to say that he introduced us. So it is a wonderful, wonderful time to have been able to spend with you today. I hope some of you have a few questions. I'm happy to talk about whatever issue you have on your mind, and who is going to do that. But I want to say thank you very much.
Okay, we have just a few minutes for questions today. We're going to start with a virtual pass
question.
We
have a few more minutes than
that. We have a few. Okay, well. So we'll start with Spencer asking one of our virtual pass attendees questions, and then if you raise your hand, I can bring the mic to you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so this first question is from Elisa Wild from Dayton, Ohio. And she asks, what is your advice to college students fighting for the First Amendment on their campuses today in light of your experience before the Supreme Court?
Well, In what, Spencer, what you talked about in I think it was at Grand Canyon, it was exactly the same thing that I went through, and is that the powers that be try to bully you. They come in, they say, you are not going to do this, we are not going to allow you to do that, and it takes people with courage to stand up and say enough's enough. Make sure that conservatives are invited onto your college campuses. Make sure that there's a Young Americans for Freedom chapter on your campus. My daughter yesterday is part of the, and my son is as well, part of the Young Americas Foundation group at our high school. And he got to come here with me, but my daughter went with them to the Heritage Foundation yesterday in Washington, D.C., to be able to learn about the Constitution and about the rule of law and some great things, and I'm looking forward to hearing what she was able to do. But it takes courage. You cannot allow the administrations on campus to dictate what you can and can't do. You have to follow the rules. You have to do it the right way. It took me, from the concept of my case, which I came up with in 2004, for my Citizens United versus Federal Election case. But I came up with the concept in 2004. I filed this case in 2007, and I won in 2010. So it takes a long time. So you don't have that much time, because I hope you're done in college before it takes 6 years. 6 years, and, you know, but it is, it takes one person to stand up and say, you know, the old Popeye, right? Enough's enough. So I'm not taking no more. So, a question in the room. Yes, ma'am.
The conservatives feel that Trump has got to finish the wall. Can we get El Chapo's money and pay for the rest of the wall?
That's a great question. So, the answer is, Senator Ted Cruz, one of the great men in the United States Senate, has a El Chapo bill, which is to take the $14 billion that was confiscated by the biggest drug lord in American history, in the world, to have that money go, and other monies, go to pay for the wall. Look, I love the idea. I really love that money's in our coffers. I wish it would just go to our debt, right? Let's just do that. But it is what the president did today in signing that piece of legislation that got the $1.4 billion for the wall, plus Mick Mulvaney has found other monies inside the federal budget, plus the national emergency to use the military's budget. He now has the money. So I could look at the El Chapo money as paying off what we're spending out of other pots. Another virtual question?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I think we all welcomed the president's invitation for more collaboration and compromise in the political process. What do you think it would take to make that happen, to migrate in that direction, and do you think it's possible?
You know, compromise is a dirty word in Washington, right? It always has been. This president wants to be successful for America and all Americans. When he was campaigning and since he's been president. He says, I am president of the United States. I represent Americans. Other presidents of other countries can do the best they can for their people. I'm fighting for us, which is a totally different way of life, right? I mean, we could talk about Obama bowing to people, but George Bush, right? I mean, you look at what we've, the trajectory of America first, the trajectory of America being the shiny city on the hill. Well, when you dumb it all down, when you drive America down, which is really, unfortunately, what the left wants to do, right? It doesn't, then there's no difference. So this president wants to succeed, but he's going to work with people who will work with him on things, and we're going to see that. We're going to have an opportunity on multiple legislative fronts. But the left, and I say this on TV, and people go crazy when I say it, but the left in Congress hates this president more than they love the country. And the president loves when I say it, but the people on the left don't like it, and the media folks don't like it, but it's true. So when you get to the word compromise, it's hard. The president, he puts out a olive branch, he puts out his hand, and they slap it. Nancy Pelosi, when the president, look, the president was at $25 billion. He went to 5.6. That's called a compromise. Nancy Pelosi went from zero to one, $1. And the insult that, I'll be honest with you, look, Nancy Pelosi is not my cup of tea, but when you say $1 for the border wall, that's what an American life is worth, Officer Singh, right, out in California, who was killed on Christmas Day, his life was not worth a dollar, okay? Kate Steinle, who was murdered in San Francisco in her district, her life was not worth a dollar. The poor young man last month who was killed by a drunk driver who was here illegally, his life was not worth a dollar, okay? It is Brian Terry. I hope all of you know his name. The Border Patrol agent, former United States Marine, who was killed in a gunfight on the Mexican border as a Border Patrol agent. His life was not worth a dollar. And the reason I say all those names is it happens over and over again over years. Year after year, we keep having this thing. The definition of insanity is to do the same thing over again and expect a different result. Well, when you don't secure the border, when you don't, and the president has a do-it-all, do-it-now approach. The wall is one part of it, but the left got focused on it. The anger and resentment that has come from these fights, which are transformative for America, makes it very difficult to work on things like they did on criminal justice reform, like the infrastructure bill, which will be up here in the next month. Look, the left just wants what they want, and they don't want to give us anything of what we want. The word compromise, you know, look, Ronald Reagan, he historically compromised with Tip O'Neill, right? He would meet with Tip O'Neill, and they'd have a brandy together, a scotch or whatever those guys drank, and they would talk about things, and Reagan would come out of there, and the president would come out, and he would have 75 or 80 or 85% of what he wanted. And Tip O'Neill would walk out, and he would get a bunch of things that he wanted, and that was called a compromise. Today, they can't even do that. They can't have a conversation. You look at the, and I don't want to belabor it, I want to get to some more questions, but you look at the president the other day, it was a month or so ago, when he had Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in the Oval Office. And he starts out by saying, hey, we're going to have a great conversation. We're going to be honest with each other. We're going to tell each other where we are. And we're going to try to be in this room. And we're going to have a conversation. And what did Chuck and Nancy just say? No, we're having a conversation, but we're not giving you anything. And that ended it right there, right? I mean, that was the starting point of trying to create a bill that everybody can be happy with. That's not where we are today. And so we got a lot of work to do to get there. Yes, sir.
And this is unfortunately the last question we have time for, but this is another virtual pass question from Michael Sanders in Riverton, Wyoming. And he mentions that you talked about President Trump's fierce work ethic on the campaign trail, but what other attribute do you feel has best served him now that he's in the White House?
That's a great question. He, you know, the president has, and having been around him a lot over the years, he has a lot of things that I love about the guy. But he's a family guy, and people don't know that about him. He cares deeply for his family. He's always with his family. He's always asking me about my family. He knows my wife and kids. Just the other day, you know, I was with him, I think it was in 2015. We were at the opening of one of his tennis facilities, and Serena Williams was there as his guest to open the facility and play tennis with her, with him. And she's a pretty good tennis player. And I would say, and a couple of my daughters play tennis, so my daughters were there with us, and we were having a great time. And in the Oval Office, this is probably a few weeks ago, but he was telling Mick Mulvaney the story about Serena Williams being at the... He doesn't forget who you are. If you're his friend, you're his friend. And I got to tell you, his loyalty to people and people's loyalty to him, you know, of the close circle of us that are around him, it's a special thing to see, because we fight for him. He fights for us. He's fighting for everybody, but he fights for us when we're under fire. You look, just as an example, to extrapolate this out, you look at what Brett Kavanaugh went through, okay? You look at the absolute insanity of the left, of what they tried to do to this man, okay? It was so outrageous what they did. No other president would have stuck by Brett Kavanaugh. I'm just being honest. He asked Brett Kavanaugh to step up to serve his country, and he was not about to back down from a fight because the left was making up stories about Brett Kavanaugh. What other president would have stood tall for? Because remember, he had senator after senator coming into his office saying, hey, we got to go another direction here because this is getting really ugly in the Senate. And the guy who surprised me the most was Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, who I've had my problems with over the years on policy, is such a nice guy. But what it was transformational in that hearing at that moment in time. If he doesn't give that speech during the Judiciary Committee hearing, I don't know that Brett Kavanaugh gets through. And he did it not because he was asked to. He did it because it was the right thing to do. So what the president does for the people who want to help this country in the future is one of the things that I recognize in his character that is pretty remarkable. We have time for a couple more questions, Andrew? One more. Yes, ma'am.
When the Mueller report is finally finished, what has to happen in order for the public to be able to see it?
She asked if when the Mueller report is finished and completed, what has to happen for the American people to see it? The Mueller report is not supposed to be made public, in essence, right? It is because it includes grand jury testimony, grand jury evidence, things that are collected that are supposed to be secret. When charges are not filed, those things go away because they don't want to harm somebody's name and reputation. In this particular case, he will write some sort of report. We do not know how long or short it will be. We know that the report's going to say, what a surprise. No collusion, no cooperation, no coordination, right? That's the most important thing. But then we want to see what he says about the Clinton side of it and on our side. The process is he submits it to the Attorney General. And that Attorney General will then read it and decide, does he transmit it to Congress in any way, shape, or form? They may have to go through a redaction process to make sure the grand jury testimony is not part of the effort, right? That part of the report that goes to Congress. You can't have that. But it's 100% in the purview of the Attorney General. He can decide it goes in a desk drawer and no one ever sees it. He could decide what pieces of it are made public. I'm urging the Attorney General, who is dispassionate in this investigation, has not been involved other than like us as a spectator of it. He has no bone in this fight. He is somebody who has known Bob Mueller because he was FBI director and Attorney General at the same time, right? Many, many years ago. So he knows who all of those prosecutors that work there. It is amazing the latitude that the Attorney General has. So I'm urging, and I know lots of others on my side are urging the Attorney General to make it as public as possible, as soon as possible. And with that, I thank you very much.
Nicely done.